Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Ask the experts about free fitting on all our kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
I'm joined now in the studio by Jim O'Callaghan, Justice Minister and Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin Bay South. Good morning to you and thank you for coming in.
You're very welcome, Claire.
I'm going to start with that search which is happening this morning again for this poor little boy in North County Dublin. And there have been questions, as you know, raised about TUSLA's involvement in the case, and the Minister for Children now has asked them to review cases, wellbeing cases on children, those cases that were closed during COVID-19. I mean, do you think it's reasonable now for people to start questioning whether TUSLA is fit for purpose, essentially?
No, I don't actually, Claire. And I think we should really await the outcome of what is a very sensitive and difficult investigation. I was speaking to the Garda Commissioner yesterday in respect of this. Obviously, the Gardaí are following a very definite line of inquiry from information they have received. And I think we should await the outcome of the Garda investigation before we start jumping to conclusions in respect of TUSLA. Like a child, if the child was died and has been buried secretly, like that is a very serious issue. But like primary responsibility for that rests with the individuals who did it. Now, I'm conscious as well there will be issues in respect of TUSLA, and Minister Foley has asked for a review in respect of the issues you've identified. But let's wait until the investigation proceeds a bit further before we start jumping to conclusions.
I suppose so. We have two active cases now where children who had previously been involved in TUSLA are missing, presumed dead.
That is concerning, but when you're dealing with situations like this, you need to get all the information. And we don't have all the information yet in respect of the child who's being searched for in Donabate. So let's just wait for the outcome of that, I think. There may be questions down the line for TUSLA. Before we start jumping to conclusions or asking questions, let's get all the information. It's a developing story, and I know the Gardaí are doing very difficult work out in Donabate, but it's important that that concludes before we start jumping to conclusions.
Let's move on to safety on our streets. In the headlines again recently, because we had an attack on an English tourist who was left struggling for their life. Now, earlier in the year, you committed to new legislation which would give power to Gardaí to stop and search people who they suspect are carrying knives. Where is that? That's the Garda Powers Bill, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's with the Office of Parliamentary Counsel. It is in the process of being drafted. I suppose one of the things I've learned since I've become Minister for Justice is that I can announce decisions in respect of policies that I'm pursuing, but it takes time to get legislation drafted. And obviously there's a lot of important legislation within the Office of Parliamentary Counsel, who are the people drafting the specific legislation. But that legislation will come in.
Did that come as a surprise to you? That you're going to have to, you could announce something and then it would take a very long period of time before it would be effect?
Like, it takes a period of time. Obviously, when I publish in the Department of Justice what's known as a heads of bill, it'll set out all the provisions that I intend. I've got approval from government to bring it in. I intend to bring it before the Oireachtas. But then it has to be drafted by the parliamentary draftsman. That takes a bit of time. But listen, I'm committed to ensuring that that powers bill is introduced into the Oireachtas this year. I believe that will happen. But it is something that I don't have complete control over. But it is certainly the case that the commitment given to give new powers to an Garda Síochána will be completed during my term.
What else is in it?
Well, there's other provisions as well in terms of ensuring that if the Gardaí are going to go to the district court for a search warrant, for instance, if they were looking for a search warrant against a journalist, they would have to announce to the court that it was a journalist whose information they were seeking or property they were searching. That arose as a result of the decision in the Supreme Court. And we need to change our law to give specific statutory protection to journalistic privilege and indeed legal professional privilege. So they're the type of issues that are going to be contained within it. The Gardaí have a lot of common law powers. I think it's important that they're set out in statute so that people are well aware of the specific powers that the Gardaí have.
And do you support the new Garda Commissioner's plan for the wider use of tasers?
Well, the Gardaí at present have tasers. Regrettably, they have to use them on occasion. I'm concerned about the fact that approximately already this year, 150 Gardaí have been assaulted whilst on duty. What I'm doing, I suppose, as a priority is to ensure that we roll out body cameras. I think body cameras are going to have a very significant impact in terms of protecting Gardaí, because it's changing people's behaviour. people know that Garda Síochána have a camera videoing them, it's noticeable that their behaviour has changed. So I want to roll them out across the force so every member has them. Mm. In terms of tasers, I hear what Commissioner Kelly said in respect of it. If regrettably, it may be necessary to roll their use out on a wider basis, but that's a discussion that we'll have with the Commissioner.
But you support him when he says that?
I support his belief. Like what he said is that it may be necessary to roll their use out more. That's something that regrettably is an operational matter that may be necessary because of increased aggression towards Garda.
I mean, you've previously said that you feel safe in the city centre. I mean, you could look at that and say, well, a 6 foot five man would say that. You know, not everybody feels safe. Do you understand that?
Yeah, at the point I was making was that as Minister for Justice, I can walk around the city and feel safe. And that is slightly unusual in a European context. Listen, I'm conscious Dublin City and indeed the other cities we have around the country, they're large places. Like we have a population in the city and county of Dublin of 1.3 million. It is going to be the case, regrettably, that there's going to be criminal activity in respect to that. But today there'll be hundreds of thousands of people walking around Dublin and other cities. Most of them feel safe and most of them are safe. Unfortunately and regrettably, some people are subjected to a criminal attack. And those people, with the benefit of hindsight, will say they weren't safe and they weren't safe. But what we can do is we can try to make it safer, and we are making the city safer by having more Gardaí out in the streets. And that's happening in Dublin. I'm going to roll it out throughout the other cities in the country as well. And if you look at the crime statistics, it confirms that criminal acts are down. And like, we have to look at some empirical evidence in respect of it. And also, I'm conscious there's a global peace index that comes out annually. The one for 2025 had Ireland as the second most peaceful country in the world. So, listen, of course, we have problems in terms of criminal activity. And if you're assaulted, you feel particularly offended and aggrieved by that. It's my job to ensure that the resources are there to try to deter that and to detect it. And the Gardaí have a very good record when it comes to detection.
But the statistics and sentiment might vary, you know?
They might, but I suppose I have to deal with statistics as well. But I think sentiment can be affected by, I suppose, what I say, what politicians say. Most people, I think, walking around Dublin City or Cork City or Limerick today feel safe as they're walking around.
And yet, the Gardaí, you know, you're saying need to use cameras to a greater extent. They need to use tasers according to their boss. You know?
Sometimes they do. Regrettably, there's a very small cohort of people who are very aggressive towards Garda Síochána and who are committing criminal acts in the country. And a lot of it, as we know, is recidivism. So we need to focus on them. I'm also concerned that we do have an issue in respect of juvenile offenders. And of course, they are treated differently by the criminal justice system. But it is the case that a lot of the antisocial behaviour and criminal activity that we're seeing through the summer is being perpetrated by people under the age of 18 years of age. And that gives rise to particular problems.
And how concerned are you about the perceived certainly increase in racist attacks?
I'm concerned about it. I met the Indian community about 3 weeks ago. I know they were very concerned about it as well. It's something that we cannot tolerate, and it's not something that we can't allow to go unchecked. In many instances, I believe, however, those offences, they were motivated by racism, but they were also committed by juveniles who were seeking to steal scooters or bikes from the individuals concerned. So we cannot tolerate a situation in the Republic where people are targeted or attacked because of their inherent characteristics such as race. And I know the Indian community are extremely concerned about it, and I am, and I won't tolerate it.
Do you have concerns, as some people do, we've heard in recent days, over the use of the Irish flag in that context?
Well, the Irish flag is a wonderful symbol of unity and reconciliation. The green and the orange have their historic perspectives, and they stand for reconciliation and unity. So it's a wonderful emblem of unity and reconciliation. What I wouldn't like to see happening in Ireland is what I sometimes see in the north when you go into a territory, an area, and you see Union Jacks or Ulster flags or other areas, you see tricolours. And I suppose the purpose of them there is they're marking territory.
Mm-hmm.
They're being used in a territorial way.
That's what people are saying is happening here, essentially, isn't it?
In some places, it may be. But I think we need to be sensitive about how we deal with this as well. Like, I would be concerned about, you know, activity going on now with people demanding that they take down tricolours in certain areas. It needs to be dealt with sensitively. I think everyone agrees with that. The City Council have a responsibility in respect of it. We need respect for the flag. We also need respect for our planning laws. Like, you can't just erect a flag on every lamppost or pole. But I'm concerned about what is clearly lying beneath it, which is a desire to use the flag for completely inappropriate reasons to suggest that this is exclusively an area that belongs to Indigenous Irish people. That's not what the Irish flag was ever about.
But you're wary, you're saying, of calls for people to be asked or told or instructed to remove those flags.
I think it needs to be dealt with sensitively, Claire. I think it really does need to be dealt with sensitively, because we don't want a situation where, you know, certain flags, there's a lot of Palestinian flags around. Are we going to say you have to take down Palestinian flags as well? So we need to be careful about how we deal with it. But also, I think people need to respect the flag, and those putting up the flag need to understand when Thomas Francis Marr brought that flag back from France in 1848, it was used as a sign of reconciliation and unity between the green and orange of Ireland.
Well, do you think people who are using that flag to mark out territory are going to listen to that message to respect the flag?
Well, I hope they would. Like, they need to understand what the Irish flag means. And they maybe won't use it for their own territorial purposes. But like, communities themselves have to have a say as well. And like, within communities, we have to say it is not appropriate to try to mark out certain territory in a way which is exclusive.
Let's move on now to transport police. We are getting a transport police force, aren't we? I mean,
yeah, Dara O'Brien, my colleague, that was a commitment in the programme for government. Obviously, it's an issue, it's a justice related issue as well, but responsibility for it rests with my colleague Dara O'Brien.
What powers will they have, or will they be relying on Gardaí to make arrests, and how will it all work?
Well, I spoke to Dara about it. We've obviously had meetings in respect of it. My own view, and I don't want to start jumping onto his territory, if I can use that term again. But my own view is that unless they have some form of powers of arrest, that it won't be a sufficiently effective force. I think it is important. At present, what happens in Onda Lewis is there's a private security firm there. But in order for them to arrest anyone, they have to contact the Gardaí. The Gardaí have to come along. So it defeats the whole purpose of having an efficient and speedy system. So my own view, and as I said to you, it's Dara's legislation, my own view is that they should be given powers of arrest.
Well, then they should be guards, surely, or how will they be different to guards?
Well, part of the problem in respect of the Gardaí, and I've got a greater appreciation of this now, there are very many units within an Garda Síochána which deal with the expertise required to respond to, I suppose, the increasing sophistication of criminal activity. But the more we establish units, the less we take away from what's the primary and important purpose of the Gardaí, which is frontline policing. Gardaí out in the streets in Dublin and in the cities and towns around the country. And I suppose the more units we set up, the more we're taking resources away from that. So I think there is a benefit in having a public transport police separate, that they'll have their own specific powers and that they won't be, I suppose, pulling resources from An Garda Síochána.
Right, so they shouldn't be part of An Garda Síochána, but they will, you believe, should have powers of arrest.
As I say to you, I don't want to start jumping into what is Dara's legislation. My own view is that they would be much more effective if they had the power of arrest.
Okay, so now you've confirmed this morning that 42 Brazilian people were deported on commercial flights to Brazil over the past 3 months, and 15 of those were serving prison sentences. So can you take us through what's happening here? Like, how does it work? Have you instructed the Garda National Immigration Bureau to prioritise people or examine people who are in prison who don't have the right to be here?
Well, it's done collaboratively. Myself, Colin Brophy, the Minister for Migration as well, and the Garda National Immigration Bureau. An operation was started during the summer. It commenced during June, July and August, and obviously it is still ongoing. But when it comes to deportations, obviously when you charter a flight, you have to identify people from the same country to put onto that flight. So similarly, in respect of Brazil, rather than chartering one flight, we decided to use commercial flights in this operation. And as I say, in the months of June, July and August, 42 Brazilian people were deported. As you said, 15 of them were persons who were in prison. I think there's a benefit in doing that. But they They were deported because they were not permitted to be in Ireland, notwithstanding the fact that they were in prison. But there's an advantage in that as well in terms of freeing up prison space, and we need prison space
but
freed up.
The Brazilian authorities then, do they agree that that sentence will be continued on in Brazil, or how does it work?
My understanding, I don't want to get into the specifics, but my understanding is that very many of them were coming near the end of their term. They were coming eligible for release and they were sent back on that basis.
Right, so you don't have to then engage with the Brazilian authorities.
Well, we've to engage with the Brazilian authorities in terms of people going back into Brazil, but these people are not, the 15 who are released are not going back into a prison in Brazil.
So it doesn't really clear space in the prison, does it?
Well, it does. There are 15 spaces now in an Irish prison which are available that weren't.
But they were coming to the end of their sentence.
They were coming towards, they were eligible for release. They probably would not have been released had it not been for the fact that they were being deported.
Are there more people in Irish prisons who may be deported?
Yeah.
Can you give us a figure?
Well, I don't want to go into too much, but it's certainly something we're working on. And again, it's motivated predominantly by the fact that these are people who are in Ireland who do not have permission to be here. But as well as that, there are people who are in prisons from different countries, and it is preferable in many instances that they be sent back there. Now, I'm conscious as well, I'm not talking about individuals who've committed offences and are in the early stage of their sentence, but there are certain offences where persons are coming eligible for release, coming near the end of sentence, I think it's appropriate that they are sent back.
But if there was a case where someone was midway through serving a sentence for a very serious crime, would they be considered under this programme?
No, they wouldn't. But where they would be considered is if they were a European Union national. They can apply to have their sentence transferred to the country from where they're from originally. But that's a process that would involve them being sent back to prison in the European Union country. And
that's
serving
different
the rest.
Though, isn't it?
That
we're talking about people who don't have a right to remain here. So it's only people who would be coming to the end of their sentence.
Coming towards people who would be eligible. It's a decision that would be made by the Irish Prison Service. But like certain people are only eligible for release at certain times.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, there's no way the Irish Prison Service could say, oh, there's somebody who's serving a sentence for murder, should we just send them back to Brazil?
That's not
that
how this works.
Happen,
okay.
Because he would need the permission of the parole board
and
to do that.
Do you have a figure for how many people are in Ireland at the moment who are subject to deportation orders?
Yeah, well, we issued this year 2,700. To date this year, there's been 2,713 deportation orders issued this year, which is considerably higher than was issued last year. And in terms of removing people through enforced deportations or returns, we have removed already this year 1,386. So it is a process that is getting more efficient and more effective. As I've said previously, if you're a migrant who's come to Ireland and you're entitled to be here lawfully, you're very welcome and welcome to Ireland. But if you're here and you're not entitled to be here and you've been served with a deportation order, you must leave.
Mm-hmm. But will they leave? I mean, if they don't leave...
Well, you can see this year we've had 1,386 persons who've been repatriated through enforced deportations or voluntary returns. So the system is getting much more effective and efficient, and people are being returned if they have deportation orders and they're not complying with them.
Are you satisfied that you have a good idea of how many people are in the state now who are subject to deportation orders and have not left?
Yeah, we do, because there's information that we get in terms of from social welfare, people who were here before, and they no longer show up on our system. And if you're served with a deportation order, it is extremely difficult to continue to stay here. Like, you can try and get work in the black market, but aside from that, you get no social welfare supports. It is difficult for you to survive here. And as well as that, you're subject to arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have a deportation order that you haven't complied with, the Gardaí can arrest you because it's a criminal offence.
I want to ask you about the Crowe report. You've guards in the force who are doing the bare minimum, we heard, routinely parking the patrol car out of sight, deliberately avoiding doing any productive work for part or all of their shift. I mean, it's extraordinary from the roads policing unit when we've 112 deaths on the roads this year. What have you done about it?
Well, I got the Crowe report at the end of May. I met the commissioner about it, I'd say 4 or 5 days afterwards. We discussed it. It is a very concerning report. I suppose what concerned me most about it was that the individuals who were interviewed were so open about the fact that they were prepared to admit that they weren't doing their work. Notwithstanding that, we also need to recognise that the Crowe report said that the majority of the roads policing unit members are productive and professional. But when you look at what's contained within the report, what really was the issue of concern and that needs to be confronted is what's referred to as the Performance Accountability and Learning Framework Directive that comes from An Garda Síochána. And very many of the sergeants and senior supervisors thought that that was an ineffective mechanism of trying to ensure greater performance within the force. If you're a member of An Garda Síochána, no matter what unit you're in, if you're a member of the public service or civil service, no matter where you are, you're being paid to do a job and you have to do the job. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the commissioner, just to conclude on this, like I said to the previous commissioner when I met him, and I've discussed it with the new commissioner as well, that I want to see the issues highlighted in that report confronted, and a project team has been established to respond and put in place performance arrangements.
But the managers and the supervisors, we were also told in the report, are really apprehensive about taking any action against people. They're concerned about the that it will create industrial relations problems with the Garda Representative Association. Now, that's something that the GRA refutes. But is that a problem? Have you been told that's a problem?
I would hope that that's not a problem. I would assume, and I believe it, that the GRA want to see that all members of the force are equally carrying their weight and doing their work. And I'm sure the GRA want to ensure that that happens. But this, there is an issue in terms of what's referred to as PALF. It needs to be changed. I spoke to Commissioner Kelly about it. I've also myself signed regulations recently in respect of performance within An Garda Síochána. Because it can't always be the case that if somebody's not doing their duty, it immediately goes to misconduct or conduct hearings. There has to be performance regulations as well.
That'll mitigate against the fear that these supervisors and managers have of doing anything about it?
I think so, yeah. Listen, in every job, there are senior managers, senior officers. They have to control and manage the people below them. I had the privilege yesterday of addressing the Chief Superintendent's Conference, the senior leaders within the force. As I said to them, a Garda force cannot exist without organisation and discipline. And in order for there to be organisation, there has to be constant review and appraisal of performance.
So are you assured now that a guard can't go into work and turn the camera, because we heard about this, didn't we? Turning the camera on the dash so it's facing the back of the mirror and not recording anything.
Well, I know Commissioner Kelly would not tolerate that within his force, and it's certainly not something that
it's been tolerated up to now, according to the Crowe report.
I know, but it can't be anymore. Like, the good thing is this has been identified. But also, can we remember as well, like when we talk about the Crowe report, I think of Garda Flatley, who lost his life a number of months ago when he was out on a Sunday afternoon. He was a member of the Roads Policing Unit and he was doing his job diligently and lost his life in the process. So let's remember that the majority of members of An Garda Síochána within the Roads Policing Unit are productive and they're professional.
I think that people would absolutely accept that. But as you said earlier, it is extraordinary that some of them felt free enough to say this, that this is their working day.
So listen, we have to confront it. We can't ignore it. The information is out there. And, you know, Commissioner Kelly has a responsibility to ensure that the issues highlighted in that report are addressed, confronted and reversed.
Listen, we had to wait a long time to hear that you were backing Jim Gavin for the presidency. Why the delay?
Well, you didn't have to wait that long, in fairness, Claire. But can I say, I'm extremely pleased now that we have two outstanding candidates looking for the Fianna Fáil nomination. I think that's a very positive position for Fianna Fáil to be in, considering that this time last month, everyone was saying, are we going to run a candidate? Who are you going to run?
Were you put under pressure by Micheál Martin to back Jim Gavin?
No, not in the slightest. Both of them are highly qualified. Both of them are highly suitable. It was an extremely difficult decision for me. But I think, you know, because the only pressure I came under was from, with the greatest respect to yourself, members of the media saying to me, what are you doing? What are you doing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I took my time. I spoke to Jim Gavin. I spoke to Billy Kelleher. Billy Kelleher is an enormously impressive politician. He's had a huge influence on Fianna Fáil. He is a really consequential person and a fine person. And it was a very difficult call for me to make and to speak to him. But having spoken to both of them, I just thought that because of Jim Gavin's association in Dublin, his achievements in terms of the GAA in Dublin and within the Oglaí na hÉireann, I thought, and listen, I could be wrong about this, I thought he has a better chance of winning than Billy, because both of them are eminently qualified and outstanding candidates.
But how do you think Jim's going to cope in the debates, you know, the interviews that he's going to have to do? That's something that he has, you know, you could say, well, he has limited experience of those types of forums.
You're absolutely correct. And, you know, I could be back here after the election and would have to admit, listen, I got that wrong. I went for Jim Gavin. I should have gone for the experienced guy, Billy Keller, who's been through this process. But it's a calculation I've made. It's a difficult election, as you know. The pressure that people are put under is intense. But I think Jim Gavin has displayed in his career to date a reliability. He's a solid individual. Like, he's clearly interested in public service when you look at the work he did in terms of the report on the mayor for Dublin, involvement in the Irish Aviation Authority. He's an excellent candidate. But listen, I may have got it wrong, but my judgment is that there are two outstanding candidates, and my judgment is that he has a better chance of winning the presidency than Billy.
There's a lot to play for on Tuesday. I mean, it's not certain, is it,
that
Jim Gavin is going to get through this process in the Fianna Fáil party?
It's not at all. And I would hope every member of the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party would do what I did. And it's a difficult process. Would just reflect on, like, both of them, as I say, are outstanding candidates. But then you get to, well, probably then, who has the best chance of winning? I could be wrong. Maybe the more people see of Billy, the more they'll be impressed by him. I know that. But just my own assessment was in terms of Jim's history and his unique characteristics.
It's interesting that you're still sort of fiddler on the roof about this. On the one
I'm
hand,
not fiddler on the roof. I've said what I've said.
But it's a secret ballot. Did you feel that you had to come out to support Jim Gavin, or why did you when you're sort of still in two minds about it? It would seem.
If I hadn't come out to him, and I was in here being interviewed by you today, the first thing you were saying, how is it tenable for you as a senior member of Fianna Fáil, a government minister, to sit there and not announce who you're voting for?
So it would have been seen as a challenge to Micheál Martin's leadership.
I hate to disappoint you. Like, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. I reflected on it. I spoke to them both on Monday. I knew I was going to have to make it. It wasn't tenable for me. I was thinking of saying this, I'm going to vote by secret ballot. If I'd said that to you, I'd say you would have run me out of the studio. But I reflected on it and I said, I knew I was going to have to make a decision one way or the other. I opted for Jim Gavin. I may be wrong. They're two outstanding candidates and Fianna Fáil's in a really strong position.
All right, we leave it there. Thank you very much, Jim O'Callaghan, Minister for Justice.
Thanks, Claire.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.